ITQ Podcast episode 420, ultra portable HF antennas. Well, hello fellow amateur radio enthusiasts, and welcome to this, our 420th episode of the ITQ Amateur Radio Podcast, supported this episode by monthly and annual subscription donors. In this episode, we join Martin, M1MRB, Dan, Kilo Bravo 6 November Uniform, Karen, KD2 Golf Uniform Tango, Edmund, Mike 0, Mike November Golf, and Ed, DD5 Lima Papa, to discuss the latest amateur radio news. Myself, Colin, M6BLY, rounds up the news in brief, and this episode's feature is a feature on ultra-portable HF antennas. Well, as mentioned, this show is brought to you by the very kind donations of our monthly and annual subscription donors, and we would ask you to consider setting up such a donation for 2024 to help us continue the work that we do at the ITQ Podcast. You can do this by following a very simple process of going to itqpodcast.com/donate and then select one of the donation options that matches the value you get from the show. So think of it like giving us a cup of coffee or a book or a trip to the theatre, something along those lines, and that is a good way of establishing how to send a donation. Right, well, now we're going to get on with this last episode of 2023 by joining Martin, Dan, Karen, Edmund and Ed to discuss and generate thoughts about the latest amateur radio news, including a SOTA challenge and Ireland's first satellite. As always, hope you enjoy.
The ICQ Amateur Ham Radio Podcast, serving the amateur ham radio community fortnightly since 2008.
Well, hi guys. Last news roundtable for 2023. This is the ICQ Podcast, episode 420. Tonight, I'm joined by Mr. Dan Romacek, KB6NU. Hi, Dan.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening to you, and hopefully you had a good Christmas.
I did. It was great.
Yeah, that's a good one. Also, we have Karen, KD2GUT. Over there in the States with you. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Happy New Year, Martin, and Happy New Year, everyone.
Yeah, Happy New Year to our listeners, as you say, and I trust you had a good Christmas as well.
It was outstanding, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm going to pop back to the UK quickly. Mr. Edmund Spicer, M0MMG. Hi, Edmund.
Hello, Martin. Hello, everybody.
Yeah, we did manage a couple of contacts on the radio over the Christmas period, so I think you had a good time, and I hope that Christmas lunch was as good as you hoped it was going to be. And last but not least, Mr. Ed Durant, DD5LP, over there in Germany. Hi, Ed.
Hi, and frohe Weihnachten und einen guten Rutsch in neuem Jahr. So, Merry Christmas, and... Happy New Year, or a good start to the new year is a rough translation. And yeah, good to be here, and hope everybody's safe and well, all the listeners, and take care in the new year. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, that's a good one, and I'm pleased everybody had a good one. And guys, this shows you what a team we have. When I said to this team, oh, by the way, there's another record session just after Christmas. In fact, we record this on the 27th. And I was expecting, due to family reasons, for no other reason, that some wouldn't be able to make it. And the whole team have made it. So it just shows that they enjoy bringing this to you as much as I do. Right, let's have a look at our first news story. There's a bit of a challenge going to happen. In 2024, there's a 10-meter SOTA challenge. Now, I think this is going to be fun because we're at the peak of the solar cycle and, you know, making 10 metres on SOTA summits shouldn't be too difficult to get a reasonable size antenna up. Ed, you're a mountain goat on SOTA. What's your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, okay. I mean, this has been announced a little while, but it's good that we're bringing it up now so that people can get ready. SOTA, by definition and by the rules, is not meant to be a competitive event. Or if you're competing against anybody, you're actually competing against yourself to improve points you get, etc. But because there's points involved, of course everybody wants to see if they're better than the others. And that's what challenges really are about. They're like parallel to the normal SOTA award scheme, in that the points are taken out of the normal database. So for the people taking part, whether they're actually the activators on the hilltops or whether they're the chasers at home or they're the shortwave listeners, they just carry on as always. But specifically for the whole of the year, which is longer than usual, challenges usually maybe 2 months, possibly 3 months. This time the management team have decided to make this a full 12 months. So through the complete year, which then of course gives equal advantage to those in the southern hemisphere as the northern, etc. Specifically, you're going to look at 10 meters contacts that are made. And basically the way the scoring for the challenge works, it's a matter of getting the maximum number of contacts. A contact, if you like, is always 1 point in this kind of scoring. So the modes that get more contacts from a summit are going to put you higher in the list. So SOTA allows any mode. So you could be running AM, sideband, CW, FT8, RITI, slow scan TV, whatever. The idea is it's actually unique contacts. So the idea behind it is to try and get contacts with more and more people and get more and more people informed about summits on the air. So the more people you actually get, that doesn't mean just the chasers that you normally work, but especially other people that didn't even know SOTA existed, that gives you an extra point in this challenge. So it's a little bit complicated. All the rules are up on the SOTA website, sota.org.uk. And it's a challenge for the complete year. It will also be useful, the data from it, to analyze when 10 meters has been good in different parts of the world, of course. So I know a lot of people are getting busy building 10 meter antennas to take to the summits, because as you rightly say, Martin, a 10 meter antenna is small enough. You can build a beam for 10 meters and take it to the summit with you and hopefully get lots of contacts. Yeah, so we'll see what comes. And they've picked, obviously, the best year for it, the top of Solar Cycle 25. And we should probably see a lot of DX around the world contacts counting. But the main thing is to contact more people from more unique summits. And, yeah. It's to publicise the award scheme as much as anything. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, well, I'd say it sounds an interesting one. Now, Dan, I know, I'm pretty sure, if my memory's correct, you've told me there are no summits where you live. But if people are operating on 10 metres, there's going to be a fair amount of CW, I thought, which could be interesting for you.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'll operate this event, and you know I'll operate from home and be a chaser. That's fine. Yeah, there really aren't any summits here, but you know even when I go out on POTA activations, I've worked some of the summit on the air guys, and yeah, it's pretty cool. And you know, like Ed has said, you know, portable antennas should be pretty easy to make. And so I'll be interested in seeing what kind of portable directional antennas the SOTA guys come up with. That'll also be a pretty interesting thing. Maybe someone can even write an article about that.
Yeah, well, I think a fair amount could come out of this over the year and our findings as amateurs. Karen, you got any summits where you are, or are you likely to do this?
Oh, we are as flat as can be here. Flat as an anthill can't even be activated here. That's how flat it is. For me to get to a SOTA summit, I would have to go into the Hudson Valley. In fact, maybe in 2024, I will attempt to do something that isn't flat. It's like activating an ironing board out here. I will chase just as Dan is planning to do, because gosh, I wish they would do this for POTA, because I love doing POTA. And I think as long as I don't have to climb directly vertically, I would probably enjoy SOTA. What I like especially about this event, though, is that it is a 10-meter event. And the nice thing about 10 meters, of course, is that probably in a lot of countries, hams who are at different levels of their license will be able to participate. They have access. I mean, here in the States, our technician class has access to 10 meters. So this is so inclusive and so wonderful. And I remember seeing the write-up on this when it was first announced, and it indicated that I believe the prior challenge was on 12 meters. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, but that the decision was made to go with 10 meters because it could include more participants. And I think that's just great. I'm looking forward to this. A whole year of this is very, very cool.
Yeah. Just quickly on that point, Karen, there's been challenges on 12 meters, 6 meters, sure about 15, but you know, there's been different ones. So as you said, one of the main reasons that 10 meters was chosen was because the technician class in the US has access to 10 meters. And yeah, there's nothing to stop you making contacts on 10 meters on FM in this as well. Any mode goes, as long as you're on 10 meters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the only minor thing I potentially see is that 10 meters also has contests on, and there are fairly a lot of contests, so there might be, you might be competing with contesters.
As SOTA does every single weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
So this
yeah.
is not this is nothing new to us.
Yeah, okay. But no, I'll just mention it. Ed, down there in the South Coast, could be a bit of fun, just putting an antenna up on the beach, sitting there in the sun, working these people on up the high summits. Or in the south of England, they're not the highest of summits, but there are a few fairly close to between you and I that could be activated. What do you think?
There are, and to my shame, I've not yet done any of them. But going back to the contests thing, 10 meters is 1.7 megahertz wide. It's the largest HF band we've got. So if there was ever going to be a good HF band to use when there was a contest on in terms of bandwidth, 10 meters is probably the one to go for. Although I'm not based in the USA, obviously, my first thought was our technician licensees can take part in this, but a slight caveat there. I believe they can only transmit between, is it 28.3 and 28.5 from memory? Is that correct?
I'd have to check.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact. Dan, would you happen to know? I know it is a limited section, but I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah, that's the phone portion. And of course, they can operate CW down in the CW portion.
Yeah, indeed. So anybody's listening to this who's a technician who thinks, oh, it might be fun to have a go using AM or FM, which would mean they would have to be above 29 megahertz, then what an incentive to upgrade your license. Superb. Yeah, regarding antennas, there's a wonderful video by Adam, Kilo 6 Alpha Romeo Kilo, where he carries, I think it's a four-element wire beam, up onto a SOTA summit somewhere. That's on his YouTube channel. And the other really good thing about this, apart from the smaller antennas and relatively low noise floor on 10 meters compared to 40 or 80 meters, for example, is, as Ed Durant said, it lasts a whole year rather than just a couple of months, which means that wherever you are in the world, you stand a chance of experiencing every mode of propagation going. At the moment, as 2024 arrives, there's F2 layer propagation here on the south coast of England. I hear America most days. As the year goes on, that will probably peak around the equinox. Then after that, sporadic E during the summer from May to June, July time. There can be some really strong signals coming in, often very localized, but if you're in the right place, they can be extremely strong. So running mega power isn't necessarily an advantage, nor is having a particularly snazzy antenna. So this has got so much going for it, and I will keep an ear out, certainly. I may even activate a local summit, you never know. But I think whoever came up with 10 meters as the band of choice and to run it for a whole year right at the top or almost at the top of the current solar cycle, whoever took that decision, I think they've made a very, very good decision, and best of luck to everybody taking part.
Yeah. Well, let's say it sounds like all the presenters are excited about this. So sounds like a very good opportunity for everybody to have a good go on 10 meters, whether you do it from home or as would be preferred from a summit. But the thing is, take part. That's all I'm going to say. Right, move to our next news story. Hams help a community radio station get back on the air. Well, I can understand why they would, because we do have a lot of experience of RF and understanding of putting things together and one thing another. So I think, you know, hams can do more of this, or should be asked to do more of this if people have problems. But Karen, what did you think of this one?
I was happy to see this kind of teamwork. This is a low-power FM station in California that was knocked off the air in a storm. They had their antenna. they were using a pine tree, 70-foot pine tree, as a mast or a tower, and a thunderstorm knocked it out. The lightning arrestor was damaged. Connectors were knocked out. It was a real mess. And the expertise they needed was delivered by a local ham radio club, some of the folks there, which is fabulous. They worked with them to try and get them back on the air, and indeed they did. Okay. I think the real significance of this is the fact that hams could provide teamwork with these broadcasters and bring their own expertise into the studio and into the actually out into the field to get things going again. I mean, who better than hams know the kind of damage that can be done to antennas when a storm blows through? But you know, more than that, this is actually not an isolated case by any stretch of the imagination. And we recently on Newsline carried a story about an effort in Australia to encourage more of these partnerships. And there was something called Technorama. Any Newsline listeners may remember Technorama having that kind of conference where they deliberately put hams and the community broadcasters together to share their expertise and to work together. There's a real synergy when you can put these kinds of folks together under, let's say, non-emergency conditions, when you can sit down and plan and know that you're not responding to a crisis, but really train one another and help one another. There's a lot to be gained from that. But in this particular instance, what was gained is the station did get back on the air with the help of the hams. Probably a lot of good lessons learned there on both counts. And so let's hope. Well, first, let's hope the station can stay on the air and has something a little more fortified now, although storms will be storms. But the relationship there is pretty solid between them. And that being the case, I think they know somebody's got their back. And that's how it should be. We're all in this together. We all use the spectrum. So I say, why not help one another? Because that's truly for the benefit of everyone. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, agree with you 100%, Karen, and certainly on a community station. Now, having worked for just over a year for a company who built broadcast transmitters, I've seen broadcast transmitters come back which have been hit by lightning. And trust me, they're not a pretty state inside when they come back. The PA block gets well walloped, and I've sort of seen PA transistors like look as though they've had a bonfire on the board. But yeah, if they got hit by lightning, then there isn't much you can do about it if you have a direct strike. Edmund, what do you think about hams helping community stations?
Well, poor old KNYO, they're only a low power station to start with, so to lose the tree that supported their antenna and then to get back on with an antenna mast just one third that height, that will have seriously reduced their coverage area. But then within months, not even years after that, to get struck by lightning, I mean, that's just, I do feel terribly sorry for them. Radio amateurs, yes, I noticed the way that the news story is worded is that the local radio club stepped in. I wonder who found who. It wouldn't at all surprise me if one of the people involved with KNYO wasn't a radio amateur. It's probably more widespread than you realise. I mean, here on where I am in West Sussex, the two hospital radio stations to the east and the west both have radio amateurs as volunteers, and the local commercial station on DAB was actually set up a couple of years ago by a radio amateur and others. He was one of the founders. So it wouldn't altogether surprise me if KNYO didn't count a radio amateur amongst its employees or volunteers already. But as you said, Martin, again, it's something we all know, isn't it? Hams, most of them, not all, admittedly, but most of them do naturally almost seem to have this sort of inbuilt instinct to help people. So I'm glad to see it's happened, and hopefully it will help give amateur radio a slightly higher profile than it would have had otherwise, Martin.
Yeah. Well, I'd say it's an interesting story. Dan, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, I'm always surprised that there aren't more hams involved in low-power FM stations. And there actually probably are, but, you know, there's not a lot of low-power FM stations in big cities, big metropolitan areas. And the reason for that, of course, is that the channels are all taken up by commercial stations. But, yeah, I mean, this is a great story. And I looked at the Radio World story on this, and the Ham Club actually did approach the station when they found out it was off the air. So it was hams being very proactive in this case. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me, right? Because, you know, what is amateur radio? Well, it's the amateur radio service, at least here in the U.S. And public service is a big part of ham radio. So I'm not surprised these hams stepped in to help out.
Good. It's a good one. Well, one of the last transmitters I fixed, and I can't tell you who the customer is, obviously, but it was a 5-watt FM transmitter on 67 megs. And you think, well, what good would that be in the UK? Well, they were actually licensed, but it's used at a football stadium where instead of running wires to all of the PA block all around the stadium, they've actually got receivers in the speaker blocks, and they transmit on about 67 megs the information, which I thought was a useful way of running a little 5-watt transmitter. So, yeah. Ed, what's your thoughts on the hams doing this?
Well, obviously, everything positive. And there are real parallels between what small community radio stations are doing and amateur radio. Talking about the storms hitting and bringing down or damaging antennas 2 weeks ago, maybe not 10 days ago, I was working here with winds that were peaking 140 kilometres an hour. And if you saw some of my masts whipping around, you'd be thinking, that does not look good. They all survived. These are the squid pools, some people call them. Crappy pools, I think they're called in the US. I might be wrong on that. But the angling, router is what they're called in German. So the fiberglass telescopic pools. And I've got my 40-meter loop on that. One's 10 meters long. The other ones are 8 meters, I think. And I said, they all whipped around and they all survived. But the vertical, the commercial HF vertical I had up didn't. It ripped its mounting out of the woodwork it was screwed into. So, you know, we all know about these things in amateur radio. So when a community group that has got together and put a radio station on the air, quite possibly not necessarily with radio technicians in their group, more coming at it from a community point of view and wanting to, you know, give community news out and play music or whatever, it is a match made in heaven. And the other thing over here, one of the radio magazines, I think it's Funk Telegram this month, has got a list of all of the privately owned shortwave broadcast stations in Europe. And I reckon at least 25% of them are owned by and run by radio amateurs. Certainly two in Germany are, and also the main Vienna transmitter station, which runs 3 500 kilowatt transmitters on HF bands and high gain antennas that are on railway lines to turn them round. The manager of that is a radio amateur. So, you know, professional amateur radio has always been intertwined. And when an amateur radio club can come along to a community group and say, we know we can see you've got a problem, we can help, that is absolutely fantastic. And both sides will gain from it through the experience. And yeah, more power to their elbows. As Karen said earlier on, there's an organisation going on to promote this in Australia. And hopefully we can start and see that in other parts of the world. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, well, as I say, it's a good thing. As I say, us amateurs do like to help out. And if it's radio involved, that's even better. Right, moving to our next news story. Global response to signals from Ireland's first satellite. Now, I think this is interesting. So, yeah, another country has got a satellite up there. I know we get a bit upset about space junk, but let's hope this has been sorted on this one. Dan, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, I tell you, every time we cover a satellite story, it makes me feel a little sad that I never did more with satellite work. You know, I bought one of those aero antennas and I made one contact and that's all I did. But, you know, satellites are very popular and this just proves it. You know, it would have been nice to get one of these cars. Maybe I still can. I don't know. But yeah, otherwise, I mean, this is a great story. First Irish satellite and more activity, the better.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was quite good. Karen, you put this story up and you spotted it. So I think it was a good thing that Ireland have now involved with satellites.
Yeah, I think it's a proud moment for the folks in Ireland who put that satellite up. I think it's wonderful. Again, putting aside the notion of space junk, which does really trouble me. But I also applaud the achievement. I know it sounds like I'm contradicting myself, probably because I am, but I think it is a good and proud moment. What I really liked about this, though, is from a publicity standpoint, the way they promoted it, having a contest among people who could be among the first to receive the signals coming from the satellite. I mean, what better way to make that this kind of excitement come home, you know, bring it home to your own shack to say, hey, I was a part of this. I think it was a very clever idea. I think it gives meaning to this for people. It makes them want to understand satellites more. I don't know if any of the winners were first-time satellite users or veteran satellite users, but just think about it. Had it been the case that you got a newbie, imagine being new to satellites and you win this competition for your continent. How cool is that? I mean, this was just very nicely put together as an event, and I was very happy to include it when we had it in Newsline. So very pleased for Ireland. But yeah, let's keep the space junk to a minimum, please. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, no problems, Karen. Well, I remember it must have been about three years ago, I was doing a contract job for the railway, and I was at a real remote station, and the station manager and I used to get bored most of the time. And I took my FunCube dongle in, just put a mobile whip on top of the car, on top of the company van. I had the back doors of the van open, computer there, and we actually decoded when the CubeSat's going over its telemetry and that. And I think by the end of the pass, I think we were about 7 or 8 customers watching what was going on. Now, fortunately, none of them missed their train, but it's surprising if you can show this thing to people and they go, "What, you've actually received that?" "Yeah, yeah, there's the battery voltage, there's the temperature, blah, blah, blah." And it worked quite well. Ed, you got to like this one as well, haven't you?
Yeah, it's good news. And the thing I read through this story as well is this is another example of the European Space Agency teaming up with amateur radio, and in this case, Dublin University, with these satellites. And as in the last ICQ podcast where the talk was about the planning for the geostationary satellite, that's for going over the Atlantic, sitting over the Atlantic somewhere. That, again, is European Space Agency working with commercial interests and with amateur radio. And I think the ESA should be complimented for including amateur radio into these projects. And the idea of making this a competition so that they got the data back the soonest, great idea. Another thing, I don't know if other amateurs know about it, but there's a system called SatNogs, SatNogs, and that's a set of linked SDR, software-defined radios, around the world that is gathering data from satellites, exactly this kind of telemetry data, and feeding it all back into a database for the satellite operators, so for the non-commercial satellite operators, to get this data about their satellites, even if they are on the wrong side of the Earth, when the satellite says, "Hang on, I haven't got any more battery voltage," or my temperature's getting too high. Through this network, this SatNogs network, they can know in advance for when it then comes round, they can send a command to say, you know, turn the power down or whatever. So, you know, that's amateur radio run, is the SatNogs. Again, amateur radio working with other scientific organisations can do nothing but good for the hobby, in my opinion. And good luck to the whoever the winners were of this. As somebody else said before, if this was your first time at getting data and it turns out to be you're the first person in your continent to get it, then you're going to feel very good about yourself and correctly so. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I agree with you. But equally, even if you're not the first person to get it, the achievement of getting it, not everybody can do this. So it's an achievement and a good achievement.
Absolutely.
Move to our next news story. Tradition carries on in Sweden. According to Karen, Karen, you put this news story in. But it talks about a transmitter, a 100-year-old transmitter. Over to you.
Yes, a 100-year-old transmitter in Sweden. It is a UNESCO site. It is World Heritage Site. Much loved SAQ transmitter, which goes on the air just a few times a year, sending on long wave. So there are not a lot of receivers left that can get it via radio. But of course, we have the magic of the SDR. And of course, YouTube, which is not radio, but it gets the job done. And there's a large there's a rather lengthy startup process for it. At Christmas time, it sends a message of peace to the world, and it does this and has done this for years and years and years. And so we looked at this because sometimes the transmitter, again, over the years, has scheduled a message of peace or some other message on a particular significant holiday, and perhaps there's been a malfunction and it's needed a repair. And we've written about that on Newsline as well. These old transmitters, particularly something this humongous, mechanical and remarkable, doesn't always function. So on Christmas Eve morning, it was fired up. It sent the message via Morse code. People were either present in Sweden on the site or were listening at home on radio receivers if they were so lucky to have one, or an SDR, or again, live streamed on YouTube, which probably was the majority of folks. You know what? There's something nice about that. We're at the point where the calendar page is turning. We're getting into 2024, and yet here's a 100-year-old transmitter sending the same message or a similar message every single year. That, to me, speaks of continuity. And it also says that the things that you may not necessarily think are relevant are still relevant. And this transmitter is still relevant. It's where we came from. It's a treasure. And hopefully it will still be used to send the message of peace and other messages for a long time to come. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I hope it will. And it's an interesting transmitter. As we were talking at the beginning of this, it's a mechanical transmitter. Ed and I was discussing, we think it might just be one level up from a spark gap transmitter. But what do you think, Ed?
You stole my lines, Martin. Never mind. It's an alternator. So, and I've just, for the people on the in the group here, the ICQ group, I've just posted a link and a picture of it to the to our little internal page, and it just looks like an enormous big generator, very very mechanical. And we all said we need to look more into this. I believe it's 17 kilohertz, 17 kilohertz. It transmits on a 17.2 or something. So you really need a long antenna to receive it, but it's heard around the world. And what, 200 kilowatts, I think? So it's a pretty powerful transmitter. And at the time, back in the 1924, it was revolutionary, and the fact that it's still working 100 years later says an awful lot for the quality of build back then. I suspect none of the modern radio transmitters will work 100 years after they were built. So good luck to the people there. And there's also an amateur radio club affiliated with the Grimmerton Alexanderson. Is it Alexanderson? Yeah, I think so. Alex Anderson, yeah, alternator, who actually got on the HF bands as well at the same time as the transmission is going on the VLF band. Great thing that it happens. It happens at Christmas. I think it happens some other time during the year as well that they power it up. And well done to the people there for maintaining it working. Really, it looks like something out of a science fiction film from the 60s, in my opinion. Well worth finding it on YouTube and having a look. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, certainly an interesting device. Now, Edmund, I know you occasionally saw a long wave. I'm not sure if you'd have been aware this was happening, but it's an interesting story, a 100-year-old transmitter that gets fired up to send a Christmas message, isn't it?
It is. My involvement with long wave stops at 153 kilohertz, which is the bottom end of the long wave broadcast band in Europe. But this isn't just LF, low frequency. This is VLF, very low frequency, 17.2 kilohertz from an alternator, as Ed has said. I was actually driving on the road for the transmission on Christmas Eve, but they routinely do several transmissions during the year. They do one on Alexanderson Day. They do one on the UN Day, World Radio Day as well, and Christmas Eve. So if you go onto YouTube and search for the channel called Alexander SAQ, Sierra Alpha Quebec, that's its call sign, Alexander SAQ Grimeton Friendship Association. When their channel first comes up, it looks like they haven't got very many videos, but if you click on the live tab rather than the videos tab, you can then see recordings that were streamed live of all their recent activity, and most of them are about 40, 50, 60 minutes long, but they do include the startup procedure, and starting everything up and getting it running actually takes far, far longer than it does for the chap to sit there with his straight key and send the message in CW. But the whole thing is well worth a look. It's really, really interesting. And the only problem I remember them having in recent years hasn't been a problem with the alternator. I think about 7-8 years ago, they had to abort their attempt to get on the air because there was a problem with the antenna and it was arcing or flashing over. I think an insulator had failed or something along those lines. So it's well worth to watch. And they also have a CW decoder in vision. So you can, if you don't know CW, they don't send it particularly quickly, but if they don't know CW, you can read the message that's being sent as it's being sent. And if proof were needed that the best CW decoder you will ever have is the one between your ears, the one that appears in the Christmas Eve video on screen doesn't decode some of the letters that the chap was sending correctly. And that was without any, you know, atmospheric noise or fading or anything like that. So, yeah, if you want to practice your CW as well, it's worth watching the latest video too. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I'll say, sounds very interesting. Dan, have we left you anything to say on this one?
Oh, just a little bit. The transmitter technology really is pretty fascinating. And my question is, and I'm going to have to do a little research on this, is how many volts are across the key? You know, that could be quite a high voltage there. So the operator just really has to be careful not to get across the key. You know, like that's why we have what they call Navy flameproof keys, because there's a very high voltage on them. And so I would imagine this is maybe even a higher voltage. But I'll have to research this technology because it is quite an interesting technology.
Yeah, and I bet you'd like to be one of the people sending the message one time, because it'd be a great experience, I would suggest.
Oh yeah, and you know, so I was looking at the different websites. You know, they have a whole museum there and all, and it sounds like if you're ever in Sweden for on a tourist, you know, as a tourist, you should stop by there and at the museum and see the history of the station. You know, it was a commercial station for a long time, and then it played a part in World War II, and so it seems like a very interesting place to visit.
Yeah, certainly does sound it. Well, that was an interesting one. They're a little bit different, and the news stories today are probably a little bit different because we've tried to have a bit of fun here. Karen, you wrote about this and suggested that there's a de-expedition before a de-expedition, and I think it's interesting. The guys are off to Bouvet Island again, aren't they?
Oh, yes, Bouvet Island. Everybody wants to get Bouvet Island, and people will have their chance again, but not before Peter, the first island, gets activated. And much of the team for Bouvet will be on Peter, the first. Same region of the world, same equipment that they're going to be using as well. I think the excitement for very, very coveted the expeditions is something that really captures the imagination. It's adventure, it's uncertainty. And for the chaser at home, it's certainly an accomplishment. And for the folks there, it's definitely an accomplishment. It is survival. Right now, the Bouvet will, of course, be activated, but Peter the First, these are Norwegian islands, that will go forward. The big activity coming in 2024 will be the fundraising for the team. But again, what's nice is the equipment will be in place for the following year's activation on Bouvet. So,
Karen, if I can just intercept there, Bouvet is first and Peter One is second.
Oh, I'm so, sorry.
Bouvet is happening in 2025, the start of 2025, and Peter the First, start of 2026.
Ah, I'm sorry.
But the rest of what you say is absolutely correct. The reusing the equipment and some of the teams common, etc.
Okay, no, appreciate that. Yeah, I believe the thing that's going forward for Peter is the fundraising. That is starting. Yes. Yeah, that's what had me confused. Apologies to the listeners. Bear in mind that the fundraising is going forward for Peter the First. That's the big activity happening this year, and they do really want people's support. There will be a remote operation. That's a new element. But these are all, of course, veteran de-expeditioners. And so it's going to be quite a batch of activations going on. I believe there will not be much, if any, sideband, at least that I've seen. But there will be digital. And of course, for those of us who are CW ops, we can get in the game as well. So stay tuned. Martin, back to you.
Yeah, sounds like it's going to be fun. Now, Ed, when we started talking about this at the start, you mentioned Emil DL8JJ, who we talked to when he activated Rockle, will be on this trip. And he's a real nice guy, so I wish him all the best on this one.
Yeah, a friend of ICQ in so much as he is such a nice person. His family's fantastic as well. And really, really love seeing him and talking to him. And yes, he's part of the Bouvet team. The Bouvet team, which I said will be start of 2025, we'll have three physical operators on the island and four people as their support crew. And the big thing there, they will be sidebanned. There'll be sideband FT8 and CW on the manned stations. And why I say the manned stations is that in addition to the three operators there, there will also be four remote controlled radio stations run by people from their nice, warm, comfortable home shacks around the world. And those four Flex 6600s, I think they are, but Flex 6000 anyway, stations are only going to be running CW and FT8. So two FT8s and two CWs. So, yeah, this for me is the big thing, is they're starting to use these radios in a box, where in a Pelican case, they've got everything in there, the control circuitry, the radio, the tuner. And that is then controlled via the satellite or by a satellite through the Skylink. Anyway, the Elon Musk network internet connectivity. And yes, that will happen on Bouvet. They will also have two sites on Bouvet, because when they went there in February of 2023, so this year, they found that their coverage into North America wasn't what they would have liked. So they're going to have a specific extra site a bit further up the island that will have a better view to North America, and the main site will be roughly where they were in February, covering the rest of the world. So, yeah, big event. And as I said, it's really nice that they're going to reuse the equipment that they get together for Bouvet for Peter One. And on the Peter One expedition, instead of having 7 people on the island, there's going to be 19. That's planned at the moment. So more people. I think it's probably easier to get people onto Peter One than it is onto Bouvet. As we know, several of the expeditions have tried to get onto Bouvet and failed. So it's not an easy task they're taking on. But this is the team that got there this year in 23, and they fully expect to be there at the start of 25. And then on to Peter One. Both are a sub-Antarctic, or they're both sub-Antarctic islands, as was said, that are owned by the Norwegian government. So they need to get the landing authority for Peter One. But for Bouvet, they've got everything, all the authority there. So big news for the people searching for that DXCC entity of either of those. And also, I would say also for amateur radio, big news on the technology that they're starting to use, which may become more and more common on future de-expeditions to rare places, because, of course, you can put a radio in a box on an island and put an antenna up and then go back and operate it from your ship offshore so that you do not impact the nature on the island. So I think that might go down well with a lot of the authorities. Yeah, okay, end of my palaver. Back it comes, and good luck to the guys when they get out there. And as Karen mentioned, they are looking for support, monetary support. So 3y0k.com will act actually for both Bouvet and Peter One Islands, the same website. So if you can give something, please do, and wish the guys all the luck when they eventually get to the two locations. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, sounds good. And Bouvet, Peter were active. A lot of people tried to get them in the log this year. Dan, did you actually get Bouvet in the log, or is this new site they're going to have make it easier for you?
Well, I don't know. I tell you the truth, I'm not a big DXer. I'll work it if I hear it, but and I've been fairly successful at that, but I'm not a big DXer. But as Ed mentioned, this remote technology would be pretty interesting. And, not only that, if you think about it, an actual station, what does it cost? $5,000 or $6,000 with a flex and a computer and an antenna. And that something like that could be actually left on the island and operate for a long time with some solar power and all. So, maybe these islands are not going to be such rare DX after who knows how long, but that's something to think about. The other thing, I was looking up these fellows that were mentioned in the report on QRZ.com, and these hams are quite experienced from a de-expedition point of view. One guy, been on more than 20 of them, and that's pretty impressive. Another thing I was impressed with is one of the fellows, and this I have to applaud this guy for this, is he not only has been to these places, but he raised money to make the, as a humanitarian fundraiser. For example, he mentions that for the 2016 de-expedition to the Central African Republic, I organized a humanitarian fundraiser and donated $11,100 plus radio equipment to Doctors Without Borders. Well, how cool is that? So, I tend to think that some of these de-expeditions are kind of a waste of money. I think that this doing this humanitarian work is a great thing. So anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah, well, it's a good piece as well. And it's interesting to find out what some of the other things go on. Edmund, have we left you much to say on this one? I mean, are you going to try and work them?
Single word answer to that question, no. And I'm going to go into full-on grumpy old man mode here, probably. The people involved with putting them on, I have serious respect for. Doing that, stumping up significant amounts of their own money, probably, to go, travelling to far-flung places, endangering their well-being, potentially, living in cramped, uncomfortable, sleepless conditions, doing all of that, I couldn't do that. I am not made of stern enough stuff, and I have the utmost respect for them for doing that. But the reason I have no truck with D-Expeditions, I can give you in two words: pile up conduct. I've got better things to do with my life than spending hours on the radio trying to get my way through deliberate QRM, jamming, banned policemen, people doubling with each other inadvertently or otherwise. And at the risk of sounding horribly ungrateful, given the lengths that these DXs go to put the activation on, I'm afraid, Martin, I just cannot be doing with it. Sorry.
No, it's a, listen, we always say on this podcast that you have your say, your point of view. Your point of view is that. I'm not going to rough you up for it. None of the group here have ever fallen out over disagreeing with what's going on. And there was quite a bad write-ups about the bad operating on Bouvet this year. So you're not wrong. You just, that's the thing that turns you off. That's fine. I understand. Not a problem.
Martin, let me jump in and back what Edmund has said. He's brought up a very valid point, and he's absolutely correct. Unfortunately, it wasn't new at Bouvet. It's been like that for years. I've done a de-expedition out of Australia to, 2012 or 2011 or 12, to Lord Howe Island, a small de-expedition, but a proper one nevertheless. And, yeah, the way people behave in the pile-up, there is a DX code of conduct and it should be followed by these people. They just simply don't. And it only takes three or four bad ones to spoil it for 50 or 60 people or whatever. So the point that Edmund is making is very true. There was indeed, I think it was the, was it the Northern California DX group put up a, set a piece of money to say if somebody can come up with a solution to this, they will pay for it. But I can't see how he gets a solution for people who behave badly. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, unfortunately, most, it's the same, not just amateur radio. It's not, let's be honest, this is not just an amateur radio problem. It's a worldwide problem. People, there are those that don't care about anybody. They just want what they want now, and that's it. So, unfortunately, we can appeal to their better nature, but I don't think some of them have understandings in that area. Anyway, before I get political and we get into trouble, I'm going to move to our next news story, which isn't an amateur radio story per se, because we're not allowed to encrypt our transmissions. However, there's a broadcast station going to send encrypted transmissions out and set up a challenge for people to decode it. Ed, you put this one in, so I'm going to let you go first on this one.
Yeah, thanks. I thought this was a nice one to finish off the show before the new year, and it's something to do in the new year. The shortwave radio station KPH, which I'm told is in California by Dan, is actually going to be sending out numbers, as you hear on the bands, and you certainly heard a lot of during the Cold War era, and making a competition out of it. And that's all going to happen on January the 20th, and going to be done on CW and on RTTY on various HF frequencies. Looking at them, they're all listed in the show notes in any case. And a challenge for people who like to decipher ciphered code. And good luck to everybody who would like to take part with that, part in that. It's actually sponsored by or supported by the Maritime Radio Historical Society. So it's you know, all above board and a bit of fun. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, well, fun's what it should be. Edmund, are you going to have a go at this?
Again, probably not, because I am not good at decrypting things, puzzles, that kind of thing. I can just about do Wordle on a good day, but that's about as far as I go. Interesting frequencies. They are, I think, all of them in the HF marine bands. They're not, they don't fall within HF broadcast bands, so
that would make sense. That would make sense since it's related to maritime radio, so yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it would certainly involve me spinning the dial in parts of the HF spectrum that I don't normally listen to very often. So I might have a go to see if I can pick the transmissions up using various wire antennas I have in the air. But I think for me, the interest would be to see if I can receive the signals rather than successfully decrypting them, Martin. That's not my bag at all, I'm afraid.
No, but it'll be something else to listen out for. And you never know, when they publish how to decrypt it or the clues on how to decrypt it, it might be quite easy and might be quite fun. We don't know that bit yet. Karen, what's your thoughts?
Well, I do like the idea of code. Obviously, having become a CW op, I enjoy putting the brain in high gear in order to try and figure out what's being said. Whether I will make an attempt here, I don't know. I think this code might be at a level that exceeds what I'm capable of doing. I have enough of a challenge with CW. However, I like that this is something that is being circulated as well in the amateur radio community, because I think there's an important principle here behind this event, and that's the principle of listening. Too many people are eager to key the mic or hit the Morse code key. We're always focused on transmitting, listen to me, I have something to say, rather than just listening. And I know I have discovered since I got my license, sometimes there's just pure joy in putting the radio on and listening, being a fly on the wall, eavesdropping on a QSO, between two folks on sideband, or going down to CW and listening to two guys rag chewing on CW. That's a pleasure, and it's a privilege, because everybody can hear everybody. So I think while this is not amateur radio, this is a celebration of being able to listen, and it's a reminder that we're not just transmitters, we are listeners, and it's a good skill to have. We should be listening to one another. So that's my takeaway on this. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, and a good takeaway is too, Karen, in fairness. I often listen on the ICQ podcast digital talk group, and if there's a couple of people having a conversation, I don't break into it. I think that it's there for everybody to use, and I'm glad to see people using it. So yeah, people and our local repeater. So yeah, listening is a great part of our hobby, as you say. Dan, last words on this one?
Oh, I love this this particular item. And to bring it back to around the amateur radio, you still will hear number stations on the air, and I've heard them on 30 meters. I haven't heard them on for a while, but for a while there, they would regularly pop up on 30 meters. And sometimes they would broadcast in Morse code. Sometimes you'd hear a woman's voice giving out the numbers in Spanish, in the Spanish language. And that was always kind of amusing. So I'm definitely going to give this a go. I mean, the instructions are all here on the website on how to do it. And I just think this is going to be fantastic. And as far as it being encoded, well, yeah, it's encoded, but they're giving you the method to decode it. So even if it was broadcast on the ham bands, I think it would be legal.
Yeah, well, that'll be a good thing. But it sounds like it's going to be an interesting piece of fun to do on the 20th of January. So,
right, and it's going to be the 20th. It's going to be on the 20th of January. So if I can actually do this, I'll report the next time I'm on the podcast.
Okie dokie.
Martin, an additional link to amateur radio with this one. The organizer is Kevin, K6TOP.
Right. So that's, once again, amateur radio rules.
Yeah, it's obviously something to do with the Marine Vintage Radio Association.
Well, yeah, KPH used to be a commercial station, and now it's really a ham radio group that's running it.
Right, but at the bottom of the instructions, it's actually signed by Kevin, K6TOP. So yeah. He's obviously involved in that side as well. So, yeah, good. Again, another item where we've got amateur radio and some form of commercial radio working together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, say, that's a good one. Right, well, that concludes the news stories. Now, the guy said to me, wouldn't it be nice if we tell you what we're thinking about doing next year? So I'm going to say, guys, when I ask you what you've been up to, if you've been up to anything that's interesting this year, last couple of weeks, great, add that in. But what do you got planned going forward? What would be your New Year's resolution? And when I get to mine, I'll tell you I failed mine last year, or this year particularly, because it didn't happen. But we all have to have some form of plan, I suggest. So, ladies first, Karen, what do you got in mind for next year?
Okay, Martin, my list is mercifully short. First off, I want to say, and I appreciate what Edmund said, my goal is to chase DX, which I love, but to avoid those pileups. And it is possible, because I know for the holiday season, the one station I wanted to get was Old Father 9 Christmas, OF9X, out of Finland. I had not worked that station since my first year as a ham, and I got them on sideband and have not gotten them in a year since. And I love that station. It's just sentiment, I guess. Well, I was up early Christmas morning and my ham alert went off, and sure enough, there was Old Father 9 Christmas on, I think it was 20 meters. And I said, okay, I had the radio on. Now, sure enough, no waiting, nothing, no pileup. He was just calling CQ. So I hopped on and worked him. So if I plan carefully, I can avoid bad behavior. And if there is bad behavior, guess what? I'm not going to even attempt to work a station, because this is supposed to be fun. This is not supposed to be combat. So that going forward will be one resolution that I intend to keep. The other thing on this very short list is, we know that portable is where it's at for me right now. And what I would really like to do this coming year is get my little POTA operation north of where I live. Unfortunately, that's going to mean braving the bridges and or tunnels, because for me to go anywhere from my QTH means I've got to go somewhere in the proximity of New York City to get out and away from it. I don't live in the city, but it's a barrier to getting where I need to go, and it's a tremendous disincentive. Nobody likes to sit in angry traffic. But my goal is nonetheless to get myself my 891 and my antennas and my tripod up and out and really start doing some serious POTA away from good old familiar home turf. And that's it, a simple list. And I hope a year from now I can say to you, guess what? I got the job done. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, I hope you do, because it sounds like it'll be fun. And I know what it's like living somewhat in a city. I mean, I live on the edge of one, and I don't drive anymore in central London, not unless I really have to. And it isn't fun, so I can understand why you don't want to travel through and over bridges and one thing and another and fight in your way. But enjoy your operation, Karen. I'm sure you will. Dan, what do you got in mind to do next year or finish off this year? I mean, I assume that you'll be writing a new study guide, because there's a new syllabus out, I think, isn't there?
Yep, for the extra class license study guide. So yeah, I'll be doing that. I also have a few other book/writing projects that I'll be working on, and I hesitate to say too much more about that at this point. But like Karen, I'll be doing probably more POTA this next year too. But let me throw this out. I think that 2024 is going to be the year of digital communication. You know, not just for me, but ham radio. You know, we just had this FCC rule. The FCC rule is about to change regarding bandwidth versus symbol rate limitations. I think the M17 guys are getting to a point where more and more people are going to be able to operate M17. You know, and there's a couple other interesting digital communications projects going on. So I'm going to go out on a limb here and predict that 2024 is going to be a big year for amateur radio digital communications.
Well, I hope so. And in fairness, I've got a TYT radio that is convertible to M17 when it makes it this side of the pond. I don't think there's anything this side of the pond happening on M17, although I could be wrong. So I expect to get a lot of emails saying I am.
Well, we'll have to get those M17 guys over to Friedrichshafen and get the Europeans going on it.
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of guys in Friedrichshafen about it, and technically the ICQ Pod Digital Talk Group can receive information in via M17, but we can't initiate an M17 call back into the M17 network. You know, it's initiation by M17 users, I believe. But yeah, hopefully it will be, because it's very, very useful having a multi digital modes. Dan, you're dead right. Okay, Edmund, what are you going to try and do this year or next year coming up?
Well, I think I would do well to experiment with antennas for the higher HF bands. Traditionally, I've hidden myself away on 40 metres for contacts into the UK and nearby continental Europe, but there seems to be more interference with every passing year on that band from the neighbours' houses. And as conditions improve, there's always the possibility of short skip contacts on the higher HF bands. So I think I'd definitely better put something up for 10 meters, not purely for the SOTA challenge, but also because that band can produce some pretty good local or semi-local contacts as well. It's not DX or nothing. And I think if I put up a vertical of some kind, a friend of mine who lives 2-3 miles away along the coast has got a 5/8 wave, maybe a converted CB antenna or something like that. And he's told me in years gone by that even from here on the West Sussex coast, he has heard people who are out portable on high ground also using vertical antennas on the outskirts of Birmingham, which must be 100 miles away, line of sight from here. And that's during flat conditions, not when there's been tropospheric ducting or sporadic E or anything like that. So maybe 10 meters is the band to go for. I do have a homebrew coax fed in the middle dipole for 17 meters. So I might try putting that up. And that will also tune on 6 meters as a 3.5 wavelength antenna as well. So two bands for the price of one. Apart from that, in, I think it's February-ish, Ofcom are going to introduce the changes, or some of the changes that were discussed in the previous episode, which includes, amongst other things, foundation and full licensees in England being able to put the letter E optionally in their call sign. So I would become Mike Echo Zero Mike November Golf. My suspicion is that most people, wherever they are in the UK, will just carry on using the call sign that they've always had, with or without a regional secondary locator, just out of habit, and especially if their call sign is well known on the bands. But you know what amateurs are like. We always like call signs that are a little bit different. So when the day comes that the letter E for England can be added optionally to call signs starting with Golf or Mike, I suspect somebody somewhere will organise an activity day or an activity weekend, if that's the right word. And no, I'm not volunteering to organise it myself before anybody wonders. But if something like that does come to pass, then I will go on just for the novelty of it as Mike Echo Zero Mike November Golf, just to give people something a bit different to get in their logbooks. And then as soon as that's over, I'll go straight back to the bog standard Mike Zero once again, probably. And the third and final thing is that in August, on the third weekend, the International Lighthouse and Lightship Weekend takes place, which is my favourite special event weekend of the year, bar none anyway. But 2024, which we'll be in that then, won't we? I think from memory is the 30th anniversary. Maybe I've got the number wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's a milestone anniversary of some kind relative to the genesis of the event. It started off as a purely Scottish thing on a very small scale, and it was only after it had been going for 4 or 5 years, something like that, that it transformed into the event that we know these days. But I'm pretty sure, without having the information at my fingertips, that next year is some kind of anniversary. So I'm looking forward to taking part in that, and just maybe trying to be on the air a little bit more. I do listen perhaps slightly more than I should, and transmit maybe not quite as often as I should. You know, I'm forever coming on here saying to people, oh, you shouldn't just sit there and wait for somebody else to call CQ. You should call CQ yourself. And then, of course, there's me sitting here failing to follow my own advice. So hopefully in 2024, in that front, I can be a little bit less of a hypocrite. Back to you, Martin.
Well, it sounds like you've got a few things planned, which is good. And if all goes well, you never know, I might turn up at the lighthouse again next year just to say hi. That was a pleasurable afternoon out, quite fun for me, and a good one. Ed, what have you got planned? I mean, you've been busy this year, not only working with us on ICQ, but on Newsline, editing the RSGB handbook, and all these things. Have you got time to do anything else, Ed?
Yeah, it looks like I have. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to cope with it. Starting off with this year, just a bit of news for the POTA fans on this group. I was out and did a POTA activation of a first-time activation of a park this morning, which went very well. And a shout-out to Ewan, MM0VIK up in the Shetland Islands, who I worked on 20 meters. And interestingly enough, he was using a just 100 watts to a 40 meter Skyloop antenna, as I use here as well. And that's also the antenna that survived the 140 kilometer gusts of wind as well. So heads up for anybody who wants to get rid of local interference. The Skyloop, if you can find enough room to get it in, is actually a very quiet antenna. It doesn't suffer from so much electrical interference as, for example, a dipole or a vertical. But yeah, but I wanted to say about the activation today was the conversations, they were all chats, or most of them were chats. People were taking the time. Maybe because it's the Christmas period, usually it's, report exchange and goodbye. Now it's today, a lot of them were, two or three overs, chats with people, and I still got, 24 contacts in about an hour. And no, it must have been an hour and a half. But, all very leisurely kind of things, and getting to know a bit about the people, and really quite a nice experience, because usually when I'm going out, I'm rushing on a SOTA summit because I'm getting frozen there. Or it's starting to rain, whereas, of course, with Parks on the Air, which I've renamed to PLOTA, P-L-O-T-A, Parking Lots on the Air, because every POTA activation I've done so far has been from a car park within a park. So this one today was no difference. So I was in the warmth of the car. Anyway, resolutions. Well, I guess to me, the definition of a resolution is what somebody says they intend to do the next year, and then quite often never quite get round to doing it or don't complete it. I have a project on that I've talked about on various ICQ podcast editions, and that's my 20 meter and 10 meter wire beam that I've been working on now, I think, for the last maybe 3 months. And it's so close to be finished. So one resolution I'm definitely going to set is try and finish trimming that to length and then try it out on a summit somewhere. And that's my resolution. The other resolution I've got is actually to meet more ICQ podcast listeners at events. I will certainly be at Friedrichshafen, and I'm hoping to be at the UK National Ham Fest this coming year as well. I'll leave Martin and the rest of you to take care of Ohio, Xenia. I won't be at that, unfortunately, in 2024, but I hope to actually meet and actually have the time to stop and talk and chat to some of our listeners who put up with my ramblings at least every couple of weeks, or every 4 weeks in my case. I really appreciate the listeners we've got, and without them, I guess this podcast wouldn't have lasted as long as it has. Following on from examples given by my colleagues, I'll also make a prediction for 2024. And I believe 2024 will be the year when the PC will move into the radio. By that I mean to run digital modes and digital HF modes, data and free DV for audio for phone will all be done within the radio. In other words, the radio will be running Linux or Windows or whatever. There's already a couple of radios around like that, and there's a major upgrade coming to one of those as well, which I'm guessing is probably going to come around about Easter time. And I think by the end of the year, it will become the normal thing not to have to connect a laptop to your portable transceiver to run the digital modes. It'll all be in the radio itself. Maybe my prediction's a bit early on that. Maybe it'll be 2025. Yep, maybe. We'll see. And anniversaries, IOTA, Islands on the Air, is 60 years old in 2024. And that's really the first one of, if not the first, portable operating award scheme. 60 years it's been going, and it's still one of the top ones, so good for them. And touching on the new regulations coming into the UK, as well as that regional locator letter, optional yes, no, you will also be able to add anything after the end of your call, UK call sign. So slash anything you like, as long as it's not rude. So I'm thinking, obviously, for Lighthouse Weekend, slash LH, which some countries have been doing anyway, but it'll be legal in the UK as well, or even perhaps slash ICQ when we maybe get together and get a few of us on the air somewhere. So lots of ideas, lots of possibles. Let's review at the end of 2024 and see how many of these actually came about. Back to you, Martin.
Ed, can I jump in there very quickly?
Please, please.
Just a personal opinion here, but I would recommend not sticking slash LH on the end of your call sign if you're operating from a lighthouse, only because if somebody spots you on the cluster,
yeah,
the cluster will report you as being located in Norway, irrespective of where you are in the world.
That's correct, and that's a problem several people have had also with reciprocal licensing. Some of the country-to-country reciprocal licensing put the country letters at the end, not at the beginning, as per CEPT, and I've seen exactly what you said. Yeah, it's taken by people like DX Summit as being the country, and they try to decode it and bring it up as the, where you are. Unfortunately, yeah, it's a problem, so... slash LIGHT would work without causing it to be a country, I suspect, but you know, it gets a bit ridiculous. And there's been a discussion on this on the SOTA Reflector, and the general answer was please don't put slash anything on the end, but of course it will be allowed by Ofcom, so we'll see what comes in 2024 2025. Not sure what comes in February and what comes in throughout the year, but it's going to be interesting. Major changes there for the UK, and also major changes to the licensing system in Australia in 2024 as well. So a year of change, we might say.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds like it will be, and some interesting thoughts you guys have had about what you're going to get up to in 2024. Just looking at my list, one of the things you mentioned, Ed, and I will reiterate this, if you see somebody from the ICQ podcast in an ICQ jacket, or even if we're not in an ICQ jacket or shirt, come up and talk to us. We don't bite. We actually enjoy talking to people. We actually enjoy listeners coming up to us and having a chat. We don't want you to tell us we're the best thing since sliced bread. You can tell us what you find is enjoyable. And say, we are a sociable bunch. We don't bite. So come up and talk to us. I've been on the talk group a bit more over the Christmas period, the digital talk group, and it's working quite well. In fairness, the ICQ podcast digital talk group takes about 10 different people a day is on average. So it's not busy. You know, you may or may not find somebody on there. But when you do, often I see the chats go on for quite a while. So that is still available and will remain so. Been fixing things. I fixed my mobile transceiver in the car, which wasn't working. Rather pig of a fault that turned out to be, something I'd never seen before. I might mention that sometime when I talk about repairing things. I did repair my original ICQ voice recorder, my Zoom recorder. I had a Zoom H2, and when I bought the better one, yeah, my grandson decided he'd like my H2. It went out to Ireland, and Colin brought it back last time he was over and said, it's no longer required. We brought it back to you, Dad. And I went, okay. Unfortunately, when I opened it up, there was batteries in it, and they'd leaked, and they'd actually eaten one of the battery connectors completely off the board, completely gone. So I had a bit of fun. You know me, I can't leave things alone. I have to get the soldering iron out. So I managed to fit a new battery connector, cleaned it all out, fit a new battery connector, That took about 15 minutes getting it apart, and then took me 45 minutes to get it back together because I couldn't get it back together properly. The case wouldn't go on. I was tearing my hair out until I realised what I'd done wrong. But that's all back and working now. So I'm thinking that becomes my emergency recall box, and then my emergency recall box, which I had, I'll find something else for it. Did build myself a one-to-one choke ballon. I think I did that Christmas Eve. Been meaning to do that for a while. I had all the bits, went to build. I was going to build two of them, and I couldn't find enough screws and nuts and bolts, that sort of thing, to make the second one. So that's going to happen at some point in time. Like you guys, I'm going to get and operate a bit more in the summer. I'm intending to do that, and when it starts to get a bit warmer in about 3 or 4 months' time, I'm going to buy a big lipo battery so I can go out and operate without worrying about my battery running out. My big leisure battery died this year, so as I mentioned before, it's got to be replaced. And last but not least, without danger of putting the kibosh on this, Frank and I have been talking about a project. Frank came up with the idea of Smart Radio, and Smart stands for Saturday Morning Amateur Radio Time. And in the UK, I'm about to start a pilot in our local library, my local library, to get the general public along, to show them what amateur radio is about, to show them we're not old fuddy-duddies and it isn't still spark gap transmitters and all those sort of things. So I've got 8 sessions booked, once a fortnight for 8 sessions, and we're going to demonstrate amateur radio, talk to people about what it's about, and explain how it's a very social hobby, but it's a great way of learning how things work. And for kids at a school, it makes some of their learning more relevant than just having to accept in a textbook. So kind of that's what I'm up to, the smart radio. Unless something goes horribly wrong between now and the 13th of January, the first session is booked for the 13th of January in the library. So I'll keep you guys informed on this one as we go forward. So all that's due to me now to do is thank you guys for turning up between Christmas and New Year to record this podcast with me. I'd like to thank Mr. Dan Romacek, KB6NU.
Well, you're very welcome, Martin. It's been a great year.
Yeah, a great year for all of us, I'm sure. I'd like to thank Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT.
Well, Martin, onward into 2024. Been great with you guys all year long. So till the next episode, 7-3.
Yeah, and we're hoping that we may actually catch up with you in Dayton. That's if you make the trip. I know you have reservations on certain things, but it'll be good to see if you make it to Dayton. I'd like to thank Mr. Edmund Spicer, M0MMG.
Thanks for having me, Martin.
Yeah, no problems, mate. And we'll keep in touch, obviously, as we go through the year, not only on the podcast, on the talk group, and various other means, mate. So good to chat to you. And last but not least, and I hope we do meet up certainly at the National Ham Fest, if it happens this year, which it should do, Mr. Ed Durant, DD5LP.
Yeah, as always, thanks for the invite. And as was said before the podcast recording started, this is the time that we're going one more time around the sun. So enjoy the ride.
Yeah, I hope to. So all's left to me to do now is to thank the guys and say 73s because we're going to move on with the podcast. So 73, guys.
73. Keep your amateur ham radio podcast advert free by donating less than a length of coax. Visit www.icqpodcast.com/donate now. For all the news, links and information, visit www.icqpodcast.com.
Now it's time to have a look at the news in brief with me, Colin M6BLY. Just a couple of bits of news here for you. We start off with the ARRL Straight Key Night to be taking place on the 1st of January, the day after this show is released, taking place throughout the whole day. Many hams look forward to this event as a highlight of the operating year, because using Morse code, you don't have to be quick or a contest, whatever it be. It's all about making new friends on the hair with hand keys. So they're suggesting you dust off your vintage radios and keys and put them back into service for the event. And say, and the great part of this is say they're really welcoming all ages to make friends and get together on the air. You can send your list of stories and station works, etc., and really just as I say, show your best fist and most interesting QSO to the ARRL for their collection by emailing straightkey@arrl.org by the end of January. So, as I say, certainly a very interesting event. Look forward to it. And I hope everybody gets a lot of enjoyment. Now, a video has been released on the history of two-way radio, and it's been created by Mark Abrams, Whiskey Alpha 6 Delta Papa Bravo. And so it looks at the story of two-way radio technology as it comes to life, and it's a narrative and a progression of systems, the simplicity of Origin's design, and the complexities of modern network trunking. Now, I'd say there's a good part of this which is very entertaining and very well put together video, so much so that it won a Silver Dolphin Award at the Cannes Corporate Media and TV Film Festival. So I'd say certainly worth a look from there. Now, I have been told, I haven't yet watched it myself, but I have been told that the back end of the video does get a little bit commercial, but certainly the front of the video is certainly worthwhile, as I say, having a look from there. So certainly worth a look for you, and we'll put a link to that on the ITQ podcast webpage for you so you can check it out. Right, now we're going to head to our features episode, which is a review on ultra-portable HF antennas by Ed Durant, DD5 Lima Papa. Hope you enjoy.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, this episode's feature from the ICQ podcast.
The title of this feature is Ultra-Portable HF Antennas. What do I mean by ultra-portable? Well, for a club field day, contest or special event station, you can pretty much use the same HF antennas that you would use at a home station, right up to large multiband Yagis on metal masts or even trailer-mounted crank-up latticework towers. If you've listened to the ICQ podcast for any length of time, you'll know that I enjoy getting out portable to tops of hills and mountains for SOTA, HEMA or GMA activations. And in this kind of portable operation, it's all about keeping size and weight to a minimum. Effectively, everything has to pack into or onto a rucksack. That everything is not just the antenna and the radio, but also batteries, logbook, food and water, as well as something to sit on, and in some cases a small bothy tent to protect from bad weather should it arrive. I also like to have duplication of equipment so that should one part fail, I have a fallback solution. This all puts pressure on size and weight, and while I prefer a medium-sized rucksack of 40 litre capacity rather than the larger ones, small and light is essential. Now, while the good old dipole or end fed wire, whether as a vertical or a sloping antenna, are used by many activators, some of the fun of the hobby to me is trying out some alternatives that provide a little gain from mountain summits or even just in parks, and that's what this presentation will run through. The first thing to consider, no matter which antenna you intend to use, is how you will support it. When going to a summit or portable operating location, in general, you don't know for sure what you will find in the way of available supports. Okay, in some cases, activators will see there will be trees available and will take a throw bag and cord to be able to use a tree branch as a support. This is very effective for the HF J-pole antennas that used to be available from the Lambda Halba online store, or you can build your own, as it's a half-wave vertical with a quarter-wave stub acting as the counterpoise. In the majority of cases, however, your antenna will need its own support, and this is where the use of telescopic fiberglass fishing poles, known as squid or crappie poles in some countries, comes into their own, especially with the pack small holiday trip versions, which come in 5 and 6 metre extended lengths from Lambda Halba, in 6 or 7 metre extended lengths from Sota Beams, or in a 10 metre length from DX Wire and Sota Beams. All of these packed down short enough to sit neatly on the side of a 40 litre rucksack. So which length should you get and why? While it's attractive to go for the 10 metre one for more height, on the top of a mountain you already have height, so this is not as important. If you want to use the lower bands, 60, 80 and 160 metres, the height is useful as the ground will detune the antenna less. But if you intend operating on, for example, 20 and 10 metres, then the 5, 6 or 7 metre poles work well. 40 metres, some will say, needs the 10 metre pole to raise the centre or top of the antenna to a quarter wave above the ground. However, I take the compromise and use a 6 metre pole for convenience and accept some detuning of the antenna by the ground. As always, portable operating is a compromise. If you go for the larger poles, you need to realise that to get the height in a compact package, the walls of each section of the mast are thinner on a 10 metre mast compared to a 6 metre one, and that makes the mast more fragile. Something that you will need to do on any of these masts as soon as you get one is to unscrew the base and add some form of padding into the bottom. This can be foam rubber, bubble wrap, or just brown paper. Why? Well, at some point the mast will self-collapse when you least expect it, and the sections will come thundering down inside the mast. Without some padding in the bottom of the mast, one or more of the fiberglass tubes will crack and later jam when you are trying to raise or lower the mast. Supporting the mast. In an ideal world, when you put up these masts, you will have a guy collar perhaps two-thirds of the way up and three or four guy cords out to tent pegs. For 10 metre or higher masts, this is almost essential. However, for the lower masts, the antenna itself can double as the mast support. As long as the base is well supported, guy cords are not essential, and after all, this is a temporary installation, and hopefully you won't have to work in high wind conditions. So, what about the base support for the mast? If you find a fence post or a seat at the portable location, you can strap the bottom of the mast to that using rubber straps. I have some that are called bongo ties that have served me well for many years, but any strap that can be tightened and released later without damaging what you are strapping around will be fine. If there is no convenient post available, there are base spikes that the bottom of the mast can sit in. I have had both the original and later versions of the Decathlon spike, and both have let me down at critical times, so I do not recommend this make, as the nut that the actual spike screws into is set in the plastic shoe, and this is a point of weakness that shears. I've since found on Amazon some completely metal spike bases from a no-name manufacturer, and these are both cheaper and better than the Decathlon option. However, they only fit the narrower poles. The 10-metre mini-mast from DX Wire, for example, will not fit. For that, I have a screw-in base that is meant to support a summer shade umbrella. Okay, so you are now on your summit, or at your portable location of choice, and you have your base-supported mast ready to go up. Or you've thrown your weighted cord over the tree branch. What about the antenna? That's what this presentation is about, right? Well, it'd be wrong of me not to quickly cover the common options before moving on to the more exotic ones. A dipole. The most basic of antennas is still a very good solution, but the basic, single-band dipole, while okay for some portable activators, has been superseded by the multiband versions. With a single support pole, we are talking about a dipole being erected in an inverted V form, and as I mentioned earlier, the wire with its cord extenders are acting as guy ropes for the mast. There are three common multiband dipoles that exist under different names for slightly different versions, but the ones most often used are the off-center fed or OCF dipole, whereby feeding the antenna somewhere near the one-third, two-third point with a 4-to-1 ballon, the antenna works on its primary frequency, decided by the length of the wire, and multiples of that frequency. For example, a 40-meter OCF will work well on 40 meters, 20 meters, 15 metres and 10 metres. The downside of using an OCF portable, some would say, is the need for the ballon, which adds weight, but even at QRP power levels is unavoidable. Going back to the standard centre-fed dipole, at QRP levels the ballon can be left out, although many operators do use a lightweight one-to-one ballon. To make a centre-fed dipole work on multiple bands, there are two main approaches. The first is to add traps into the wire at the correct points, so that, for example, a 40-metre centre-fed dipole may have a trap inserted halfway down each leg to make it into a 20-metre antenna as well. The radio waves on 20 metres see the trap circuit as the electrical end of the antenna wire. Of course, multiple traps for several bands can be added. However, even with lightweight traps, such as those available from HF kits in Holland, the antenna's weight and space needed when packed increases. The second way to add bands to a centre-fed dipole is to add links into its length at the correct point for whichever bands you want to support. These links or clips can be small and lightweight, and so get over some of the problems with the trap dipole. However, the use of links means that when you want to change band, you need to lower the antenna mast, open and or close the needed links, and make sure you do the same on both sides of the antenna, before raising the mast again. Despite this inconvenience, this is probably the most used ultra-portable dipole design, and it can be bought from Sotabeams or made yourself using the calculator and Rob DM1CM's Antenna Design Simplified site at sota-antennas.com, where he has design tools for several portable antennas. The other commonly used portable antenna is the end-fed wire, and this comes in two basic forms: the end-fed half-wave and the end-fed random-length antenna. And again, these are available commercially, or you can build your own with the help of Rob's website. The difference between the two end-fed options is that the end-fed half-wave is an antenna that is resonant on one band, uses a 49-to-1 UN-UN, and can be made to work on multiples of its frequency in a similar way to the off-centre-fed dipole. The other end-fed antenna deliberately is made with a wire that is not a half wavelength on any band that it is required to cover. It uses a 9-to-1 UN-UN, and you must have an ATU between the radio and the UN-UN, or your radio has a built-in ATU. In a similar way to the vertical antenna, both of these end-fed wire antennas need at least one counterpoise wire or multiple radial wires. This brings possible trip hazards to the station and the addition of the UN-UN and possibly ATU weight to the rucksack, taking up space. In operation, this weight and space usage is on the ground and not at the top of the mast. The end-fed antennas are a good choice when using a line thrown into a tree. Quarter-wave verticals are less often used on summits, as they are single-band, need a mast and radials, all of which adds complexity and weight. So, those were the more normal solutions for SOTA, HEMA and GMA activators. What about some of the more exotic wire antennas that bring gain? Over the last 3 years or so, I have tried three of these designs with my own modifications added. The 40 or 20 meter VP2E, vertically polarized two element antenna, the vertical 10 or 15 meters Moxon held up between two 6 meter masts, and my latest project, the switchable direction trapped inverted V two-element wire beam. With all of these antennas, more space at the summit is needed, and so these are not my normal SOTA antennas. Rather, I use them when there is a special summit-to-summit event on where I know I will be able to go to a summit which is easier to access and I can stay longer with little public foot traffic. In the case of two of these antennas, I use my surveyor's large tripod to support the mast, so the chosen summit has to have only a short walk, as I have to carry the tripod in addition to the loaded rucksack. These antennas could well also be of interest for clubs who want to set up a contest or special event station. I should state very clearly at this point that all of the antennas that I talk about in this feature I did not design, and give full credit to the original designers. I have, however, adapted some of the antennas for my use, and those adaptations, along with web links to the original articles, and usually with the story of problems I hit and circumvented, can be found on my website, which can be reached via dd5lp.com or vk2ji.com. Both URLs go to the same place. The first exotic portable wire antenna that I want to talk about is the VP2E. This antenna was designed by Swiss amateur Fritz HP9SL, but found favour with the Eastern Bloc Amateur Radio Contest Station back in the 70s. To look at the antenna, it looks like a double-sized off-center fed dipole antenna. It is supported in inverted V configuration with one support mast, and the feed point is part the way up one side. This side is effectively the driven element, while the other side is the director element. Critical with this antenna is the height of the mast, the angle of the wires and their cord extenders where they meet the ground, and the exact point where the feed point is. This was originally designed for use in low band contests, 80 and 160 metres, but the antenna will scale to all of the HF bands, and I built one for 40 metres and one for 20 metres. I also tried to create a multiband version with links, but this simply does not work as the angle of the wires needed are different for each band. So this is a single band, vertically polarized, directional antenna with a gain of around 2.5 dB over a dipole. This is less than half an S point. However, where the antenna is useful is in excluding stations to the side of the antenna and to a lesser extent to the rear of the antenna. Of course, once erected, the main signal goes in a chosen direction. So this is a good antenna only for activations where you're aiming mainly for stations in one rough, about 20 degrees wide, direction. Rotation would require the lifting and moving around of the ends of the antenna elements, and while possible, is not convenient, especially if you have a really high mast with separate guying cords. My second interesting antenna experiment was the vertical Moxon. A Moxon antenna is normally mounted horizontally, but to support a 10 or 15 meter Moxon antenna with its spreaders requires a solid mast. I should point out here that multiple horizontal Moxon antennas sat within each other is effectively what the very efficient spider beam HF beam is. But while applicable to club portable contesting and special event stations where a solid mast or even a crank-up tower is available, this is not a solution for a single operator on a summit. Indeed, even a single 10-meter Moxon on a summit would require a more solid mast than the fishing poles that I have. So given that fiberglass poles do not affect RF as carbon fiber ones do, I decided to build a vertical Moxon for 10 meters and later a second one for 15 meters, which is supported vertically with two guide outwards 6-meter fishing poles. This is an antenna with some good forward gain and front-to-back ratio, but again, is a construction that is hard to change the direction radiated when in use. This is a single band, single direction beam with a gain similar to a two-element Yagi. While still wanting an antenna with some gain, I also wanted one I could use on a summit that can be turned to at least four different directions without having to take the antenna down and put it back up again. That is when I came across the switchable two-element wire-inverted V beam. This is two inverted V dipoles coming up to the same feed point at the top of the mast from directions 90 degrees apart. Using relays, pairs of these four half elements can be switched to be the driven element, where via a one-to-one ballon they are connected to the feed coax, and the two remaining half elements are connected together with a capacitor to electrically shorten their length so that they act as a director element. This antenna is, like the VP2E, critical on the angle of the wires coming down from the feed point to the ground pegs via the insulated cord extenders. However, here we have the same angle being needed for all bands, 56 degrees to the vertical, and this means I could add links for different bands into all four half elements. To avoid having to lower the antenna to change bands, however, one of my changes to the original design is to add traps made from kits at the point a quarter wavelength on 10 meters down the wires from the feed point board. The wire after the trap continues on to be a quarter wavelength on 20 meters, making this into a two-band 20 meter and 10 meter antenna, Of course, additional traps for 17, 15 and 12 metres could also be added. My other modification over the original design of this antenna is to get rid of the need for the relay control cable and the relay control box by using an Internet of Things 4 relay control board. These are available as either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi operated, and at £20 to £25 each, the components on them are worth more than it would cost me to source and build the original cable controlled board. I chose to go with a Bluetooth control board and control it from a simple USB Bluetooth terminal app on my smartphone. As you will have heard on the recent ICQ podcast shows, this is the antenna that is presently a work in progress with me. And while the electronics are working, after adding in the traps, I need to retrim the four wires to resonance. As the antenna is too large to fit in my garden, I do have permission from a local landowner to use his field for test. But over the last month, unfortunately, the weather hasn't let me do much testing and trimming. I have already, however, tested the version without the traps using Whisper, and it looks likely that the antenna does indeed provide the claimed 5.5 dBi gain and 14 dBi front-to-back ratio, or close to it. Again, this antenna is not going to provide lots of gain. However, its low-angle radiation pattern and the ability to null out unwanted signals from other directions is what it's all about. The last project is still a work in progress, and although I have an article ready, I am waiting until I complete all my tests and use the antenna from a SOTA summit before I post the latest article to my website. Well, I hope I've given you some ideas about building and trying some experimental antennas. Always test first at low power. Remember, there is no such thing as a bad antenna, but it's bad if you forget to plug it in. It only remains for me to wish all ICQ podcast listeners a happy and above all healthy new year in 2024. And I hope to meet some of you on air or in person in 2024. 73 from Ed, DD5LP.
From all of us here at the ICQ podcast, including the boss, Mrs. B, we want to share our heartiest congratulations to our colleague, Ed Durant, DD5LP. Ed is the editor of the new 15th edition of the Radio Society of Great Britain's Handbook for Radio Communication. Ed, here's to you.
Cheerio.
73.
Cheerio.
73.
Well, everybody, I really hope you got some great interest from our last feature of the year from our friend Ed Durant, DD5 Lima Papa, about ultra-portable HF antennas. Many thanks, Ed, for providing that feature for, our last episode of 2023. Now, as always, as you'd expect from your ICQ podcast, 2024 will be packed not only with your episodes every fortnight, but our plannings are ongoing about events and places we're going to be going to. And we were planning only yesterday some of our trip to Dayton, Ohio for Hamvention, our first visit there, I think, for 5 years it was since we were last there, Dad, and a slightly smaller team going this time, only slightly smaller, but we're certainly looking forward to that trip to Ohio in middle of May, aren't we?
Yeah, there are pictures of us turning up on the workbench podcast stand. And there were more of us than them, the bright orange all over their stand. But we do get on well with the guys. And, yeah, because we have links also with Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm sure we'll meet up with a number of those guys. All the way down the thing, most of the podcasters get on, so it's a good one to be there. And something Ed said, and I did say this in the chat at the end, don't be afraid of coming up and talking to us. Yeah, please, if you see us, either with or without our orange shirts, we're very sociable people. We're into the hobby. We love to chat to you. So, please come and say hi or whatever. You know, we do appreciate being spoken to, and we all chat to you and be very happy about that. So, yeah, a number of people have done in the past and have become quite close friends in some ways. So please do. I think that's fair, isn't it, Colin?
Yeah, certainly is. And as I say, you know, we never bite. We always gratefully receive coffee, and as I say, or even recommendations of where to get good coffee or good food. And you can help us out, particularly when we're out of our usual familiar surroundings. You'd be surprised how many times we take a recommendation from a fellow amateur to help us along our way. And as I say, so do come along and say hello. Tell us, obviously, about your enjoyment of the hobby. And as I say, it'd be great to always catch up with everybody as we go throughout the year. So anyway, so that's a Dayton Hamvention, as they already in the calendar for next year. Hopefully we were talking as well, but we're hoping the UK Hamfest to be on as well. We're still waiting for final confirmation of that as well. And there'll be a few others dotted around as well. I'm sure you'll see some of your ICQ podcast presenters that as well. So do certainly come along and say hello. Right, well, I think, as I say, so I know you've seen saying, Dad, that the Digital Talk Group has been, you know, blipping away nicely over the Christmas festive period. Not sure if it's people getting new radios for Christmas or having some time to check it out and, as I say, check from there. But it's great to hear that, as I say, that group's working away. You can find out more about it by going to the ITQ Podcast webpage, itqpodcast.com, and there's a link there for the Digital Talk Group to get involved. But Dad, you've certainly been having some fun on that talk group over the Christmas period.
Yeah, certainly have, Colin. I've had a little bit more time. And, yeah, it's as I say to people, it's not the busiest in the world. Fine, we understand this. But on average, there's about 10 people a day using it, which is better than some talk groups. Going forward, you can obviously do it in multi-mode, so you can use D-Star, a Fusion, DMR, M17, P25, and NXDN. So we're not excluding people. Come along and have a chat. And what I will say is, I occasionally, and I still see it, people just blip it. If I'm on the talk group and I see you blip it and you don't put a call out, I assume you just don't want to talk to somebody. You just want to listen. So I don't come back to you. Put a call out. You never know who's listening. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
And well, you don't have to talk to me. That's fine. If you want one of the others, put a call out for their call sign. Maybe they'll answer you.
No, certainly would be the case. So do check that out. As I say, go to the ICQ Podcast webpage with all the details you need to get involved. Right, well, we'd like to do some thank yous. Say for this episode, we'd like to thank Dan Romacek, KB6 November Uniform, Karen Eve Murray, KD2 Golf Uniform Tango, Edmund Spicer, Mike Zero, Mike November Golf, and Ed Durant, DD5 Lima Papa, for taking part in the news round table. And also say thanks again to Ed for doing the feature for us at this episode. We do appreciate that. And of course, big thanks to all the presenters throughout 2023 for being involved, and everybody that's made themselves available for interviews and features along the way. We do appreciate it, and it really does show that ethos of the ICQ Podcast being a show for amateurs by amateurs. I always talk about the three T's: time, talent, and treasure. When it comes to podcasts like this, value for value model, so they've given up their time and their expertise along the way to help us produce the show. But we'd also like to thank obviously everybody that's donated, helped us pay our way and keep us going this year. Really do appreciate everybody that's taken part and done that for us. Treasure, that money you send us, does pay our way. It pays our hosting costs and our websites, etc., along the way, so we do appreciate that. It doesn't go towards trips like Dayton Hamvention. That comes out of our own pocket to do the work for you. But we ask if we can get our hosting costs covered, etc., we'd be really chuffed, because we really do enjoy doing the show for you. So thanks to everybody that took part and did those donations this year. You can do your bit for 2024 and help us out by doing a very simple thing. Go to icqpodcast.com/donate. Think about the value you got from the show. Maybe compare it to a cup of coffee or going to the cinema, buying a book, etc. And you can send us a donation that represents that value. And everything we get goes into our running costs and keeps everything ticking along, like the Digital Talk Group as well. We really do appreciate you considering us. If you haven't done so, the video from the Ian Keyser interview from a couple of episodes ago is now available on YouTube. and you can find that and all our other video interviews we've done this year by going to youtube.com/ICQ podcast. So I say you can check that out from there. Right, I think that just about wraps up everything, Dad, for 2023. As I say, as we release this show on the last day of 2023, as we're getting ready soon for the first one of 2024. But before we do that, you need to go rummaging in the back of the cupboard and see if there's any goodies left over from that Christmas stash, or is it a shoot down the road to find something nice for Mrs. B to go with her cup of tea for this morning.
Yeah, no problems, Colin. Well, I'm going to make Mrs. B a drink in a minute. We will probably pop out in a while, and we have got things in the cupboard. We'll probably pop out in a while, and we're over the next day or so, we'll be taking down the Christmas decorations, so we're ready for the new year. So that'll be good. I'd like to wish all our listeners and friends and presenters a very merry, happy new year, and let's hope it's 2024 is a good one.
We certainly do. So, happy new year to everybody. And we'll catch you all on the other side. 73 is all.
Yeah, 73.